KQED. Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, a whirlwind week in Sacramento as the legislature sends dozens of bills to Jerry Brown's desk. Big winners include immigrants and low-income workers. Also, why a plan to build more water storage at Shasta Dam has local businesses plenty worried.
Not only are the resorts going to go down, but also the stores, the bars that are not underwater, they can't survive.
And it's got to be one of the toughest jobs around, investigating the premature deaths of kids in L.A.
I don't think I ever realized what poverty was like until I started doing this job and going into people's homes. And yet, to sit and talk with me for an hour when it's so painful, I can't imagine what it must be like.
Those stories, plus why neuroscientists are studying health benefits for seniors singing in choirs. It's the California Report. Well, the state legislature burned the midnight oil this week, churning through hundreds of bills before heading home late Thursday night. Lawmakers sent Governor Jerry Brown legislation that could make history on issues ranging from raising the state's minimum wage to a controversial oil drilling technique known as fracking. Here to talk with us about the week's dramatic finish, our Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow. Scott, let's begin with the bill to allow undocumented immigrants to get California IDs or driver's licenses.
In the last week of the session, this is one of those bills that was declared dead, and bills in Sacramento are kind of like superhero characters or soap opera characters in that they're dead, and then suddenly they're not dead.
Undead.
And this bill came up on the very last day. It was revived in the Senate. There had been some hesitation from actually Latino lawmakers. They did not like amendments to this measure that would put some sort of mark, some sort of visible indication on the driver's license saying this is not a full driver's license or an acknowledgement of legal status in this country. But they were able to work around that. They realized that this was a broader goal. They tried to get past Governor Davis, Governor Schwarzenegger, and now Governor Brown is going to sign it into law.
California could be on the verge also of raising the minimum wage over the next 4 years. They're talking about phasing it in under legislation that was passed this week. Talk about that, and you know, what's the governor's attitude, do you think, toward that bill?
Governor Brown kind of departed from his typical approach to legislation this week, and that was really interesting for Capitol reporters. Typically, he takes a hands-off approach. He does not say whether or not he's leaning toward or against a bill until he's actually signed it or vetoed it. You have to wait and find out. But this week, on the minimum wage, Governor Brown sent out a press release saying, I support this. Legislative leaders support it. I will sign it into law. He did that with a fracking bill as well. This measure will increase the minimum wage from $8 to $10 between now and 2016. That would give California the highest minimum wage in the country on the books at $10 an hour. This is something that Republicans criticize, business groups have a lot of concerns about, but Speaker John Perez said that it's the right time to do it, given that the economy is on the rebound.
And during the worst moments of the economic recession, we didn't move forward on the course because we were, in fact, in a much worse economic position, and we did, in fact, have higher rates of unemployment.
So perhaps that's an indication that next year, especially, the Democrats in charge of things here in Sacramento might get a bit more aggressive on restoring some of the cuts and is spending more money. They've been hesitant to do those things while the economy's recovering.
Scott Detrow, one bill that's on his desk, more friendly to business, would regulate a controversial method of gas and oil production known as fracking. Quickly just describe what that is and where SB4, the bill that got passed, is with regard to the environment especially.
This became a big issue this year because California is likely on the verge of a very big oil boom in the Monterey Shale Formation, and drillers are going to use this technique of fracking to get to that oil. It involves a lot of water, a lot of chemicals. This is one of those bills that end up going to the governor's desk. He says he's going to sign it into law, and that's despite the fact environmental groups hate it and business groups hate it. There wasn't a lot of big, broad consensus pushing this forward, but a lot of legislators, particularly Democrats, said they would love to see an outright halt on fracking. They realized that is not a political possibility, so they viewed this set of regulations and especially information that drillers will have to turn over to the state as the next best alternative for them.
And finally, Scott, next year, of course, is an election year, and Jerry Brown hasn't said for sure he's running again, but the smart money certainly says he will. How does this legislative session, do you think, position him heading into 2014?
I think that he can point especially to the Democratic voters next year. He can point at a lot of accomplishments, a budget that was balanced this year compared to the major deficits of the years past. There were several factors going into that, but Brown is going to be able to position himself to take credit. A lot of bills passed this year setting California up to aggressively implement Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act that's going into place. And there's a lot of measures that are going to his desk this week that are things that Democratic voters care about. A lot of the typical things that Democratic politicians like to tout, he can say, we took that on, we got it done.
And maybe prevent anyone on the left from thinking about challenging him during the primary.
That's right.
All right. Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
After a fairly dry year, California's water watchers, including farmers, fishermen, and the folks who fight wildfires, have to all be hoping for more rainfall this winter. Meanwhile, debate continues over California's biggest reservoir and whether it should be even bigger to stave off water shortages. The idea to raise the height of Shasta Dam has been bandied about for a decade, and it's getting close to decision time. But as KQED science editor Craig Miller reports, the controversy has not dried up.
Good, baby.
Every summer weekend, the boat trailers line up on launch ramps around Shasta Lake. To a newcomer, it's a bit like boating on Mars, raw red earth exposed by the receding waters in every direction. But the regulars are used to it. Donna Souza is here with her family from Marysville.
It's low, but we've seen it lower. So it's not too bad.
The reservoir on the Sacramento River, 230 miles north of San Francisco, is at about half its capacity and well below its normal level for this time of year. But what worries folks who live around here is the prospect of higher water.
We are standing on the crest of Shasta Dam, a little over 600 feet in height.
Brian Pearson manages Shasta Dam for the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. The sprawling lake it contains is the main holding tank for the Central Valley Project, which moves enough water to irrigate a third of California's farms and to cities from Silicon Valley to San Diego. This summer, the Bureau released an environmental impact statement on a proposal to add as much as 18.5 feet to the height of the dam. The billion-dollar project would add about 20 feet to the depth of the lake in the wettest years, water that could be banked for dry times. Preparation and construction would take years. It would mean moving roads and bridges and inundating some businesses around the lake.
It's unavoidable. There are several privately owned homes and some privately owned businesses that could not be protected.
At 18.5 feet, it will be sitting right at my largest cabin. So it'll be out of the, it'll
where
be underwater.
Where we're standing now.
Cabin number 14, where we're standing right now, yes.
Harold Jones and his wife Arlene have owned the Sugarloaf Cottages for 20 years. He says a government buyout of his property will force him into early retirement with few alternate job prospects.
If they send us on our way and I lose my income, you know, how am I going to support my family?
And not just his family. Jones and others we spoke with believe that raising the lake will be the death knell for the resort town of Lakehead, a tiny town whose year-round population of about 500 balloons in the summer months.
Not only are the resorts going to go down, but also the stores, the bars that are not underwater, they can't survive. They need the summer business. And so Lakehead will die.
But Lakehead is short on saviors. L.A.'s Metropolitan Water District has made raising the dam a top priority. And there's growing political pressure to get moving on more water storage for California.
We can't function effectively without additional storage.
Tim Quinn heads AQUA, the state's main trade association for water agencies.
Particularly trying to accommodate the needs of the fisheries, trying to accommodate changing climate conditions, we are storage short in this state.
The Westlands Water District, a politically powerful agency that supplies water mostly to farmers in the San Joaquin Valley, would put up about $200 million toward construction costs. Westland's general manager, Tom Birmingham, says it's a bargain.
If you're talking about creating surface storage in the state of California, this is the best project in terms of bang for your buck from the perspective of providing water for fisheries, providing water for human uses, and providing hydroelectric generation.
Birmingham has been putting his money where his mouth is. Westlands has already spent more than $30 million buying up land around the lake, clearing the way for expansion. But one fact is inescapable. Building a bigger dam doesn't create more water.
That's right.
Jay Lund directs the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Records show that winter rains and spring runoff fill Shasta Lake to capacity about one out of every 3 years. But Lund questions whether that's often enough to justify the cost of the project.
If you build a small dam, you'll tend to fill it and empty it every year. And so you get a lot of, you can work that investment pretty hard and get a lot of water out of it. But as you get larger and larger, then you might not refill that dam but every few years. But you still have to pay for that dam every year.
Supporters say expanding Shasta makes sense because the dam is already there. But the project has been awash in controversy. Environmentalists question the claimed benefits for salmon downstream. Native Americans with deep roots along the McLeod River say it would put many of their remaining sacred sites underwater. But up around the lake, there's a growing sense of inevitability.
This is what it is, and I think it's going to happen. I do.
But even if Harold Jones is right, Congress will have to approve the plan, and opponents could tie it up in court for years. So Jones could have a few more years with his cottages. For the California Report, I'm Craig Miller.
Next week, we'll hear from Craig Miller about why a popular California river may hold the key to whether Shasta Dam is expanded or not. When a child dies in Los Angeles County, Denise Bertone is often the first one at the scene. She's the county's only child death investigator, and she spends hours, days, sometimes weeks gathering evidence. KPCC's Deepa Fernandez followed Bertone on her daily rounds and brings us this profile. One note of caution, this story may be disturbing for some of our listeners.
How many cases do we have that need attention?
Denise Bertone has been investigating child deaths for the last 11 years.
About 118 right now. That's a very typical day for us. We did about 38 autopsies, about 4 juvenile or infant deaths.
Bertone's job is to figure out how a baby died.
A written log, I find it's easier because there's a lot of unique spellings of names.
She flips through a giant notebook, her neat cursive script recording the details for every case.
And these are all the children that we've had this year.
The cases are emotional and a challenge to investigate.
We have children who die while sharing a bed with parents. I think we have approximately 32 unsafe sleep environments.
These preventable deaths bothered Bertone so much that she became an advocate. She helped the county design and execute a public service campaign this past spring to warn parents not to co-sleep or put toys or blankets in their baby's crib. Her latest case?
A 4-month-old little girl died in the hospital in the intensive care unit at Children's Hospital. And it was reported that she was found unresponsive while sleeping.
The investigation starts by talking to the detective who responded to the family's 911 call.
Well, the mom is saying it was, this is where it's buried because I spoke to the trainee that was out there and he got the impression.
Bertone takes a doll with her when she investigates baby sleep deaths so distraught parents can demonstrate to her how their baby was sleeping. In her years on the job, Bertone has seen many families in pain and shock. The family she visits on this day is no different.
I held her when she was born and I got to hold her again for the last time when she passed.
Okay. After today's examination, your daughter's going to be ready for release to whatever mortuary you select. Once you make arrangements, they'll work it out with you to come to this office, to come to our office and pick her up.
She was a really happy baby. She used to like us to cuddle her while she slept. we miss her. I miss her because she used to sleep next to me.
So, Denise, you've just come out of, you know, very emotionally intense experience trying to get to the bottom of what happened. Can you just tell me how you're feeling right now?
Well, I think there's been so many questions and you feel so bad for them. I don't think I ever realized what poverty was like until I started doing this job and going into people's homes. And yet, to sit and talk with me for an hour when it's so painful, I can't imagine what it must be like. This is just the doctor's office. Hi, my name's Denise Bertone. I'm calling from the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office.
No one knows how the baby might have wound up face down on the bed. Bertone rules the death accidental. Denise, you know, how do you leave here and just go about what you have to do in your own life once the day is done? As mundane as go to the grocery store or...
Or to... go sit and have coffee with a friend and listen to what a bad day at work they had in their office. Hey, Lana. Hey, Lana. She's a good girl.
Bertone is 50 years old and has two adult children. She starts her day at 5:30 so she can finish up early enough to play with her dogs in the park and tend to her rose garden. Over the years, Bertone says she's learned not to take her work home with her. But it's always a challenge, like when she recently saw a friend.
See, he showed me the picture of his daughter the other day, and I'm like, it's a picture on his iPhone, and the first thing you do is it's like, oh, no bruises. You don't even think of things normally.
The numbers of children dying keep climbing in Los Angeles County. Bertone gets about 20 new cases each month. For the California Report, I'm Deepa Fernandez in Los Angeles.
The San Francisco Bay Area doesn't have a very large Cuban or Puerto Rican population. Still, the region has played a central role in the evolution of Latin jazz, while also supporting an avid and sophisticated salsa scene. The new album Salsa de la Bahia offers a vivid introduction to Bay Area artists and bands captivated by clave. That's the essential rhythm of so much Cuban music. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert has this review.
While Cal Jader isn't included on the 22 tracks of the new compilation, Salsa de la Bahia, the man most responsible for infusing the Bay Area with Afro-Cuban grooves casts a long shadow over the collection. The Swedish-American vibraphonist launched a popular Latin jazz band in the mid-1950s, powered by Cuban percussion legends like Mongo Santa Maria and Willie Bobo. Percussionist Benny Velarde, still active at 83, was present at the creation, recording with Jader on his classic 1954 Mambo albums for Fantasy. He's represented here by two tracks with his Super Combo, a band that served as a finishing school for many musicians featured on Salsa de la Bahia.
La herencia de nuestro ritmo, creando la integración. Cal Jader lo trajo a Mongo. Pete and Coke, los Escobedo. En el piano, Federico. Con su rancho de Panamá.
The infusion of information from Cuba, stoked by Jader, inspired homegrown musicians like the Escovedo brothers, John Santos and John Calloway. But a steady flow of talent from Latin America also played an essential role in energizing the scene. Like the great Cuban-born percussionist Jesus Diaz, who arrived in the U.S. in 1980 as part of the Mariel boat lift.
Quédate sentada donde estás, le digo de buena forma, voy a comprarte un helado.
As the name suggests, Salsa de la Bahia doesn't focus solely on Latin jazz. A mostly instrumental genre more geared toward giving musicians room to improvise than inspiring dancers. On this double album, salsa shares the spotlight with hard-charging dance music by percussionist Carlos Caro's Visión Latina, Santana's Carl Parrazo, and Edgardo Cambón, like this piece, Madre Rumba, Padre Son, by his band Candela.
Moreno africano, esclavo a Cuba llegó. Y para salvar su historia, a su hijo se la enseñó. Y a todos los orillas.
Trombonist arranger Wayne Wallace, a major figure on the Latin jazz scene for three decades, curated the collection, focusing on active bands. Rather than including tracks from one of his Grammy-nominated albums, he recorded three new pieces with Estrellas de la Bahia, or Stars of the Bay, an orchestra featuring top Bay Area players. The Bay Area's long-standing passion for roots music has made its mark on the Latin scene, too. There's almost nowhere else in the country you can find a band like Orquesta La Moderna Tradición, which is dedicated to the 19th-century Cuban-style danzón, an elegant but decidedly unfashionable sound featuring flutes and violins rather than brass. In a fitting move, Wallace closes the album with the percussion workout Rumba Para Paul. On a scene sparked by a non-Cuban, Cal Jader, there's a beautiful Bay Area symmetry to concluding with a piece commemorating the late beloved Dutch-born drummer, Paul van Wageningen, who reigned for years as the region's first call Latin jazz drummer.
Rumberito, Pablo.
My only quibble with Salsa de la Bahia is that many influential bands and artists didn't make the cut, like Rebecca Mauleon, Conjunto Céspedes, Fito Reynoso, and Mark Levine. But since the album is billed as Volume 1, there's a good chance that these combos and others will get a moment in the spotlight too.
Andrew Gilbert is a Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed the collection Salsa de la Bahia, a collection of SF Bay Area salsa and Latin jazz. That is the sound of a new choir warming up in San Francisco called Community of Voices. To join, you don't need any singing experience. The only real requirement is age. You have to be at least 60. That's because this choir is singing not just for fun, but also for science. KQED's Lisa Alafaris has the story.
Two-year-old Francisco Sanchez stands in the back row of this 18-member choir of seniors. They're rehearsing in an auditorium tucked behind San Francisco's Mission Neighborhood Center. Sanchez has suffered from depression and fights what he calls negative thinking. So when he saw a flyer in his apartment building advertising the choir, Community of Voices, he thought he'd give it a try.
Everybody are so kind, so nice, so I feel like I am in home.
Sanchez says he looks forward to Friday rehearsals, and after just a few weeks of participating, he's feeling better.
The worst thing that happens to a person, especially older person, is depression. And you feel important with something useful, depression is gone.
Right about now, you might be thinking, do we really need a study to show singing in a choir has health benefits?
Everybody says that. So they say, of course, we all know that singing in a choir is good for you.
That's Julene Johnson. She's a cognitive neuroscientist at UC San Francisco. Johnson is interested in the quantifiable health benefits of singing in a choir. Right now, there's almost no hard data. But Johnson is looking beyond the somewhat predictable psychosocial benefits that Sanchez is already experiencing. She's interested in physical mobility and cognition, too.
So those three areas will be the primary things that we focus on looking at. Will there be change, actually, after singing in a choir?
Besides his mood, Sanchez has noticed some other changes.
That's helped me for my breathing. You know, I have already 5 pneumonias. Breathing is important, but here I am practicing.
Johnson and her team will launch a dozen choirs, most in English, some in Spanish, in San Francisco over the next 4 years. They're recruiting a diverse group.
It's very important to be able to design studies that are relevant to individuals of color. And as you might imagine, singing in a choir in the, almost comes from any culture.
Está lindo, pero ahorita no es armonía, ahorita es unísono. Okay, so what's unison in comparison to harmony?
They're also working to reach vulnerable seniors, people who might not get out too much. Bilingual choir director Martha Rodriguez Salazar says some of them are quite timid at the beginning.
They're very afraid of singing or afraid of making mistakes or thinking that they're too old to do anything. The more I teach them and how to stand in front of an audience or sing or breathe or just hold their binders, you know, that really empowers them.
The researcher Johnson says holding binders in front of you, getting up and down off a stage, standing and singing, all of this can build strength.
If we can make the choir singers have a stronger lower body strength, have them fall less, they're going to be less often in the hospital.
Which could save money. And that could make a difference to senior centers relying on government funds, needing to prove their programs have made a difference.
These days when they're cutting programs at senior centers left and right, those senior centers need additional evidence that it actually could be cost-effective programs to do.
Julene Johnson has also connected with Oakland-based StageBridge, a senior theater group. Together, they want to study the effect of musical theater on senior health. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Alaferis.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. The director is Susie Racho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, Chad McClymans, and David Marks. We want to say goodbye, good luck, and thanks to our summer interns, Carly Naren and Rachel Marcus. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.